Hi, y'all. I'm Katie Parker. I am an alcoholic. Let me get this organized here real quickly. Little house cleaning. Cute glasses. I'll use them if I break my other ones. Those aren't cute. They actually go with my outfit. Let's see if they're strong enough. Oh, those would work. I've had the gift of sobriety since October the 28th of 1984. And I have to tell you guys, if you heard my husband, how many of y'all heard my husband last night? Oh, he's just wonderful. But, you know, the best part is if you picked up on his sobriety date, I have 5.5 months more than he does. Oh, come on. That, people say time doesn't matter. Oh, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. When he's struggling in the house, I always tell him, you know, honey, in about 5.5 months, it'll all make sense to you. Just hang. I am all about fun, let me tell you. My home group is the primary purpose group in Austin, Texas. We study the big book line by line. Week after week, we have over 200 people studying the big book. Isn't that wonderful? We are big fans of the big book, and that was not always my experience. In 27 years of sobriety, I have been on every side of AA I think you can be on. I am somebody that will give you my opinion on an experience I have had, and I have been on about every side you can be on in AA. And I like this one the best. Boy, I had no idea that every answer to every problem I have is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd have told you at a time in my sobriety that wasn't true. I got big problems, and I did not know that. And today I just look at it from a completely different set of glasses. I want to thank David for asking Charlie and I to be here. This is wonderful. I mean, it really is. There's a lot of people that are involved in putting these things on, so I'd like to give them all a big hand. Charlie and I have the privilege of traveling quite a bit for AA, and this is the third weekend in a row that we have done one of these. We try not to do that many in a row, but this is the third weekend in a row, so we're calling this the trifecta. And so we've gone from Canada to Reno to Edgewood. Let's end it in East Texas. Yeah. So, you know, and I, Larry did a great job. Let's hear it for Larry. He did a wonderful job speaking. We missed the Al-Anon today. I'm sorry. It takes me 1 hour and 10 minutes to get ready. This was actually 1 hour, so I had to miss the Al-Anon speaker. But sure, I heard that she did a wonderful job. I also, you guys have met Sparky. Ted introduced Sparky. And, you know, Sparky is, he really has an interesting history. The fact that he's in an alcohol, have you ever been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting before? Never have. Now, he has worked our steps, but the thing about Sparky that's so interesting is he's got these two boys and Larry are his dear friends. So we all know that they are serious alcoholics. And he's not an Al-Anon. He is a hard drinker. And so given sufficient reason, he was able to stop or moderate. That's a dandy. That's damn lucky is what that is, mister. You dodged a serious bullet there. Yeah. So we get to do this day in and day out, and it's actually wonderful. But it's great to have you here, Sparks. And I know his son, and he went to school in Austin, and I just got to meet his wife for the first time. But he and Charlie have been friends for years and years. Well, let's see. We're in the senior center, right? That kind of feels comfortable these days, doesn't it? Yeah, I went to y'all's meeting, your clubhouse over there, and which is wonderful. It just feels just like a wonderful AA place, but that bathroom is a trip. I think it's a sobriety test is what it is. I think you're thinking, I think they've been drinking. Let's see what they do with that step. I thought, holy smokes, I don't think my dress will spread up that high to stay. Wowza. You know, the other wonderful thing, too, about being in Texas is you don't have to explain to people that Texas is not the South. Oh, my gosh. Everywhere we go, people say, so you're from the South? It's like, no, I didn't say I was from the South. I'm from Texas. How difficult is that? It's Texas. Texas is Texas. So I'm with like-minded people, thank goodness for that. But I got sober when I was 26 years old. I'm 54 years old now. I've been sober 27 years. I have a 33-year-old daughter and a 23-year-old son. I have three beautiful grandchildren, Charlie and I do. The oldest is almost six, and then the other two, one has one that's 1 year old, and the other one has another one-year-old. And I swear, I think grandchildren are God's do-over. I mean, for drunks, is that not the best? For anybody that suffers from alcoholism, those grandbabies are do-overs, man. I swear, Max comes up to me and says, "Graham, can I have a popsicle before dinner?" I'm like, "Have three." Man, run with the scissors. Watch as much cartoons as you want. I am no longer the disciplinary, right? I have at it. But, oh my gosh, those grandbabies are just fabulous. But, you know, it's interesting. At 54 years old, I mean, I'm clearly on the back nine, right? You know, I mean, I'm not living to be 108. I am on the back nine. I just some days hope I'm not putting on the 18th hole. Are you with me on that? You know what I mean? I kind of want to coast on out there. But, you know, the book says the most satisfying years of my existence lie ahead. Is that my experience? I ask you to lay that up against what the book says. Are the most satisfying years of your existence happening right now? And that's, in AA, I could say some days yes, some days no. But today, now that I am where I'm at in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the 12-step work, I can tell you it's unbelievable the relationship I have today with my Creator. And that was not my experience in 27 years. And we're going to get to all of that stuff. But my husband told you I'm a little bit like taking a drink out of a fire hose. He will pick up on that real quick if you hadn't already. I mean, sometimes I'm a little bit more than you expect, and your lips just blow right off your face. You know what I mean? I mean, it just comes at you. And I'm extremely passionate about alcoholism, and I sometimes get, you'll just get an opportunity to see that, okay? No more explanation. I do want to tell you, though, that one of the things that I understand today with where I am in work in the 12 steps is that I am the vessel to get you connected to the power, right? That's what my job is with the sponsee. I am merely the vessel to get you connected to the power. I am not the power. As a matter of fact, I can't be the arbiter of anything in your life, but I can darn sure be the vessel to get you connected to that power. The book says that that my message must have depth and weight, that I have been given the power to help another drunk when nobody else can. That's pretty spectacular stuff. I can help another drunk when nobody else can. So my message must have depth and weight. The book says it has clear-cut directions that will get me there. And so that's what I'm gonna go into the rest of the story of where I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous in 27 years. First of all, I was the youngest of three kids. I think a lot of the importance of our childhood comes because there are old ideas, right? I mean, the family that you were raised in, Charlie was raised in an educational family. I wasn't. My dad was educated, but he could have cared less if we went to college or not. And we were also from a family of yellers. I mean, the one who yelled the loudest won in our family. Do we have any yellers in here? Thank you. Come on. Work with me, people. Work with me. It's okay to be a yeller. And Charlie came from a family where you turn the other cheek and the big pink elephant sits there and nobody says anything. So you can imagine how lovely this goes together when you try to get married. You know what I mean? I'm yelling. He doesn't like the yelling. You can't really shut a yeller down, right? I've not heard your Al-Anon story, but when you said you threw the milk into the ceiling fan, you're my sister. You know, I'm telling you, I'm right there with you, sister, you know. Slam something to the ground, and I love slamming a door. Make sure that hair flies. Just to show you how mad I am. But that doesn't go real well with my husband, but we work on that. But I'm the youngest of three, and born in 1958, and you know, back in the 50s, most parents, you know, they had kids about every 2 years apart. And we're tooling along, and my dad was actually an ex-NFL football player, and he played for the Steelers, and really only 1 year. He was mainly known for the Miami Hurricanes. But he was he was a partying kind of guy. I mean, he was entertaining. Like the movie Mad Men, it was exactly what our life was like. He was just, alcohol equaled fun. My mother was just a beautiful, well-educated woman herself, and she, I don't really think she was looking forward to having three kids. I think she wanted kids, but she wanted to party. And the two of them were just constantly having parties at our house. So alcohol always looked like fun to me. There was nobody knocking anybody around in our house. Booze looked like fun. I looked forward to doing booze. And then all of a sudden, fast forward, my mother gets very, very sick when I'm 8 years old. And the next thing I know, she dies overnight. She dies of a kidney disease. And from that point on, when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have swore to God to you that the reason I was alcoholic is because my mother died. And if you had to go through that kind of pain, you would have drank too. And boy, do I understand today, I have an allergy that's driven by an obsession. I understand today that I know pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I understand that when I start, I can't stop, and I can't stop starting. It's got absolutely nothing to do with my mother dying. I have a genetic bullet. That's what caused alcoholism. It runs all through my family. And today I get that. But I tell you, I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous believing that the reason I was alcoholic is because my mother died. And nobody's fault. Trust me, there's no blame here at all. I mean, I'm sure people were explaining that to me, the allergy and the obsession. I just didn't hear it. We alcoholics only hear what we want. As a matter of fact, you're going to hear me say things that I never said. So don't come up here with issues with me. And, that's just the way we are. We alcoholics only hear what we think we hear. And we will swear that that's what it is. It's interesting. And we are the most judgmental, self-entitled group of people. Would you agree with that? I need some head bobs. Yes, right? We're not talking to the PTA here, right? I need this. I need this going on. And what you'll do with this talk, I loved it. Larry said it, is you'll judge me. You'll go, oh, no, I like that. No, I disagree with that. Oh, that's not bad. That's pretty good. It's interesting. And at the end of the talk, you'll grade me. And I'll make somewhere probably between an A+ and a C-. And then you'll go in the bathroom and talk about me. That's what you do. So I try not to go to the bathroom right away. I've walked in there when I've heard people go, oh, I didn't care for her at all. And I walk in, I'm like, here she is. Don't be doing that too quick. You know, but that's one of the deals about this. That's why we love each other. You people are my tribe. This is the only place I feel that comfortable with, is a group of people that can have me say that, and they go, you know what, boy, wow, that's really how we are. And so what ended up happening after my mother died, my dad, get a load of this, my dad remarried 3 times in 18 months. He's a player. Oh, yeah, my dad the player. And in that 18-month period and the 3 moms or 3 wives, he put 4 live-in housekeepers in there. So I had 7 women in my life come through my life when I was between 8 and 10, and that's why I thought I drank. But today I understand that what that did is that influenced my old ideas. So in watching this behavior, I just have a ton of old ideas based on how men are, how mothers should be, how marriage looks, right? Are you with me on that? Now, I don't know I'm doing this. Oh, my gosh, who knows that? You know, once again, when we come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're not scholars in this arena, you know. And so I have no idea that influenced my old ideas. I just know that, boy, it was crazy in the household. One of the mothers, the best, this was the best, she was... her name was Phyllis. I remember that much. She was in the home 6 weeks after we buried my mother, and she lasted a weekend. Isn't that shocking? I swear, when I even hear myself say, I go, really? Now, my dad has since passed away, but I would just love to sit him down and go, so let's talk about that, Dad. Really get... Let's get down to the real dirt. What's really going on? I mean, that is just bizarre to me. But that's what was happening. And the other thing is, you know, I started drinking at 12, somewhere between 11 and 12. I remember my first drink, but I just cannot remember if it was the summer of the sixth grade. I'm sure if I did the math, I'd come to the exact age. But it was 11 or 12. And I remember the drink. And I do remember the first drink. The first drink made me feel pretty doggone special. It took away a lot of that pain, boy, and I had a ton of pain of the confusion behind losing my mother. And when you're a kid, I don't know about you guys, but for me, it's hard to find booze. You know, you can't be going out and buying booze at 12. It was a little difficult. And you're going to get caught if you drink too much of your folks' booze. It was just too difficult. So I have extensive use and outside issues because they were just a lot easier to get. But I'm very respectful of singleness of purpose, so I'll just set that aside. But I'll tell you how we got booze at 12, is we sat in front of that 7-Eleven, and it was always three girls. And we were on our bicycles, and we waited for that creepy guy to pull up. You know that creepy guy, girls. Yeah. And you waited for the creepy guy to pull up. And then when you saw him, you went, that's our boy. And you said, hey, can you buy us some booze? And he goes, boy, I sure can. Now, keep in mind, we're 12-year-olds. We're not innocent 12-year-olds. You know, we're pretty wild 12-year-olds. And our biggest job was to get rid of creepy guy. I mean, it was like trying to flick a booger off your finger. You know what I'm saying? That creepy guy. Now, he was in a car, but we were on our bicycles. And we rode right into those woods. I mean, you're just riding along. Looking back, I think we lost him. I think we lost him. Keep going, keep going, keep going. You know, and we're just flying into those woods. And the best part of this story is that the creepy guy is in this room. I know he is in this room. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I can sense the creepy guy. I can be standing at the coffee pot going, what is the creepy guy is somewhere around here. I feel him staring at me, man. And you know, guys, I know some of us, you know, sometimes you'll get a speaker that's got an opinion, and, well, you've asked a speaker that has an opinion here. You know, one of the things that sometimes happens in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I got to say as a woman is a delusion, is that this is the little girl at 12 years old that was picking the mark out at the 7-Eleven. I can handle the boys in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what we women do is you take away the booze, and the first thing that's going to pop to the surface is my sexual powers. It just happens. And the truth of the matter is that gal in AA is going to come to the men and say, I don't like women. I never have liked women. It's a very typical statement women say. And your job as a man in AA is to march her right over to the group of women and to turn around and walk away. Do not buy into that foolish stuff that she's trying to pull on you. That there's boys in AA that are trying to hit on her. She can handle them. There's not a creepy guy in AA that I can't handle. Have I got an amen from the girls? Come on. Come on. Jeez Louise. One little girl came up to Charlie at our meeting and said some boy was, bothering her. And I just happened to overhear that. And I turned around and said, honey, come to me. Don't go to my husband. I can handle that boy. Trust me. You know, of course, I did tell her she got up to get coffee five times like this, you know. I said, it may have gotten the scent out there, okay? Yeah. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. So, now, the other thing, too, guys, is, okay, that was my little rant. I got about two or three of them. You'll pick up on them when I have them. But we girls can handle just about anybody in AA. And so here's the other deal is talk about the beauty of the inventory process. The inventory process is it opens my eyes to see self manifested in various ways is what causes my failure. How does Katie show up in life that causes me failure? Manifest just means show up. So how do I show up in life that causes my failure? I'm driven by my old ideas. Heck, I don't even know what they are. But here's a perfect one. I cheated all the way through school. I did not enjoy the academic experience at all. And so, I mean, I didn't enjoy any of it. You know, the dangling participle, I don't think is necessary. I don't think the Dewey Decimal System is important. You know, I don't really even care where Venezuela is. Are you with me? I'm 54 and still don't care. And so but what ended up happening to me is I left home at 15 and nobody came looking for me. That just goes to show you the level of pain in the ass I was, okay? By the time I was 15 years old, my father was so done with my shenanigans that when I said, you know what, I don't like it here anyway, and he goes, fine, then go on your own, and I left. And I never came back at 15. That's pretty unbelievable for a girl. The really important part of the story is nobody came to get me. I was kind of hoping for that to happen, right? But he didn't come to get me because that's how much of a problem I was, guys. My dad didn't have to work an Al-Anon program to figure that one out. Now, he worried sick about me, I know. But the truth of the matter is that behind these old ideas, I still finished high school because I felt like if I didn't get that diploma, that the world would think I was stupid. And if I was stupid, I'd be a loser. And I had no idea. You know, you talk about that one today in that meeting. And that was amazing because I knew I wasn't stupid. But I didn't know how to convince you guys I wasn't stupid. And what ends up happening, thank God for the inventory process. Because someone like me does not need to go to college. I did not get robbed. My alcoholism did not rob me of my education. For me, I'm not a big fan of it. For my children, by God, I want them to get educated. Don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan of college. Just not for me. And that's what the inventory process taught me, was that I'm fine. As a matter of fact, I was a very successful businesswoman. I just retired December 3rd after 30 years in Austin, Texas. I was in the fitness business. How smart do you have to be in the fitness business? And you know what I mean? There's no trigonometry in fitness, okay? And it was so interesting because I retired, and Austin's about 1 million people, and they did a huge spread in the paper for me retiring. Well-loved jazzercise instructor retires after 30 years. Like, I mean, we got IBM, Applied Materials, Samsung, Dell. There's people retiring every day. Not me. I get a spread in the paper. See, and that's where I would get these constant reminders that says, God, Katie, was that an old idea? And here's the deal, guys. I cheated all the way through school, and every once in a while, it really shows up. I mean, I traveled the world for 18 years in marketing, in the fitness business, talking on marketing with no education. Never fooled anybody that I didn't have an education. It would rear its ugly little head from time to time, and I'd step on my tail. But there was a kid that came into our AA meeting from, he was from Norway. Oh, my God. And I sponsor this little girl that we call each other Dumb and Dumber. I mean, she is equally as well uneducated as I am. And she said, isn't he from Norwegia? And I said, silly, he is Norwegian. And I swear there's about five people standing around. They all went, huh? I think we both missed the mark on that one. Oh, and then, you know, I marry my husband. His whole family is educators. They love museums. Oh, my God, I'd rather put a bullet in my head than walk in a museum. But I swear, I'll ask Charlie, I'll say, how do you spell this? And he goes, let's sound it out. Oh, there's no let's sound it out. Oh, and I go, I'm telling you what, I will go crazy behind that. I mean, no, you just sound it out. Just tell me how to spell it or I'm asking somebody else. But I have learned, you know, I am not smarter than a fifth grader. We drove by OU one time. We were doing a speaking in Oklahoma, and the campus was there. And Charlie goes, God, isn't that beautiful? And I said, you know, it looks like a prison. No, it's just not my cup of tea. But one of the reasons I say that is because sometimes people come into AA, and if they aren't educated, I want to do inventory to understand if you're afraid that if you think you're stupid, you may, in fact, go get an education for all the wrong reasons. And if you go get an education, do you have any idea how difficult that is to do the older you are? Lots of times I see people put their AA program on hold, and sometimes they don't even stay sober through it. So I'm always telling them, if you want to get an education, let's be sure we do the inventory process to be sure that that's where God wants you to be. Not because, see, people, they never think about education like this. They'll go get the new car and the new house and the this, and they're always trying to fill that black hole. Well, education falls in that one, too. So be very, very sure. Well, I was speaking with a bunch of people in Florida one time, and every one of them had gone back to school to get their education. And sometimes I get afraid that the new guy thinks that if you get sober, you need to go get your education if you didn't get it. Well, we don't know that for sure. We don't know if you're supposed to have babies. We don't know if you're supposed to be married. We're supposed to do the inventory process because, remember, I'm merely the vessel to get you connected to the power. The power's going to tell you what you need to do, not me. Oh, my gosh, you do not want me managing your life. Oh, trust me. Oh my gosh. So, long story short, I want to get sober. I got sober when my daughter was 5 years old. I chased a boy in AA. He had 6 years sober, and I thought that was fascinating. I knew long before I went into AA that I had a drinking problem. I knew I could not stop. I did everything. I tried the drink. I tried not hanging with these people. I tried drinking at other bars. I knew there was something wrong. That's what we know. This isn't a shock. I mean, I didn't know I was really alcoholic, but I knew I had a drinking problem. I chased a boy into AA, and this is what I love. He had 6 years sober. He's originally from Huntsville, Texas, but he'd been living out in California, and he'd been a member of the Pacific Group. You know whose group that is? Clancy. And so I'd heard about Clancy on day one, right? You know? And so Joe was what we called a big book thumper back then. And I chased him into this AA room, and I did exactly the same thing that Larry did. I walked into these rooms and I fell in love with you guys. The life that you had, the laughter you had, the light in your eyes was just an absolute turn on to me. And let me tell you guys, that's not everybody's case. There are people that walk into AA and go, "That is a group of sick people. I want nothing to do with them." That was not my experience. I am one of the lucky ones in that area because I fell right into the middle of the herd. As a matter of fact, I think for women especially, the prettier you are, the more dangerous it is. There's three things that are in danger of getting sober: too smart, too much money, and too pretty, be boy or girl. And those are very dangerous things when we come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had these women surround me. And the thing that they did that was a little different than what I see happen today is they took my phone number. They took my phone number because I'm not about to call somebody. Now, they gave me their number, but I'm not going to call them. Really? Call some stranger? Hey, Mary, Melissa, Michelle, what was your name? You know, I'm not really feeling very good. Forget it. My pride wasn't about to let me call somebody. But they called me about 7 times a day. I love that. I think that is a piece of AA that's missing in some areas. And so these guys, I mean, they just surrounded me, and I just fell in love. And then this guy that I had chased into Alcoholics Anonymous kept going, "Katie, this is all wrong. I'm 6 years sober. You got 10 minutes. It's wrong." It's like, no, it's not. Come into my vortex. Because we women have that vortex, you know what I'm saying? Oh, come on, nod your head, girls. Be with me. We know our powers. Come on. Come to the light. Come to the light. He'd go, "It's wrong." "No, shh." And, well, needless to say, this is going to shock you. We got married. We got married. We were married for 20 years. It was unbelievable. I am so grateful. The book says that we are not to be the arbiter of anybody's sex life. I am so glad that somebody didn't say don't have a relationship with another person for a year. That is not at all what the literature of the book says. Now, I'll tell you, you better put your seatbelt on. That road is going to get really bumpy. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you are going to have serious problems. But you're not going to get drunk. Why would we get drunk? You know, the book promises me if I stay close to him and perform his work well, he'll take care of everything I needed. Joe would read me the big book and I would sit at his feet. Oh, it was fabulous. It was like, just tell me more. You know, and we had just fabulous. It was just fantastic. It was unbelievable. And after 3 years, and he had me doing everything. I mean, I'm out there, I'm carrying the message, I'm working the steps. We're all about the book. I'd met Charlie. Charlie had, well, he had 5.5 months less than I did then, and he still does today. And I had a year sober, and he was just coming in with his little less than 6 months. But he said, I'll never forget, he was in a meeting, and I just fell in love with Charlie Parker. And I leaned over to Joe, and I said, "Oh, my gosh, Joe, that guy is a riot. We got to get to know him." And we were the young people of AA. I was 26. Charlie was 28. Joe was 30. We were the young people of AA. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Don't look that way right now, but doesn't look too bad, huh? And so we became fast friends. Charlie was my best friend. Absolutely loved him. Joe loved him, but Charlie and I had this special relationship. We'd ski in the morning. There was no sexual tension. You know why? Because I don't play that way. You got to have the girl that doesn't play that game. That's how that whole deal works, right? The girl doesn't play that way, and Charlie had never had that. And we just had this amazing relationship. And so Joe and I were 3 years sober. We're all doing the AA thing. We're having all these AA events everywhere. And Joe says to me, he says, you know what, Katie? He goes, I think we should go to church. And I thought, And I didn't really have anything against church. I was raised Catholic, you know. They were speaking Latin, you know. I swear to God, you know, it was like, whatever, you know, speaking Latin, doing this with the wafer, you know. And, I mean, I didn't know. My whole task was just to flick a booger on my sister, try to get her upset at me at church. And, you know, I mean, I didn't really get one thing or another out of it. And so I said, no, I don't really think I want to do church. And he said, no. And he said, remember the line in the book that says, for if an alcoholic fails to enlarge his spiritual life. Well, I thought there was a period there. That's all I heard. And I thought, well, I do believe the book does say that. So we went to church. And he said, Katie, this is a really cool church. It's non-denominational. And so we walk in. I'm all nervous. We walk in, and I don't know if you guys have ever been to one of these churches, but they got the big screen in the background with about five lines on it. Everybody's singing, and I mean, they are this, and it was the young people, and I mean, I thought, oh, this is some oh, I am feeling it. I am feeling the power. And I mean, before you know it, I mean, by the time you're finished singing those five lines about 800 times, you think you're Tina Turner, you know? Going at it. And I mean, I am just like, oh my gosh, I love this. And they were all young people, and I just felt, you know, fit right in. And I just kind of realized that we just drifted from AA. We did not do it along with. Right? That's the problem. We did it instead of. Now, we kept all our AA friends. But before I knew it, and this is the tricky thing, guys, and I mean no disrespect, especially because I'm in that midst of Texas, that this can be heard incorrectly. I absolutely became a Jesus freak. I found Jesus. Oh. And I felt like I needed to come to AA to get you heathen drunks to church. Do you know that person? Oh, I know that person's in the room. Come on. And before I knew it, I had run everybody off with my whole Jesus thing. And I told Joe, I said, something's wrong. I mean, we were looking Amish. Because alcoholics are chameleons. Where do I have to fit in? I even started wearing underwear. Okay, there you go. Telling you. And so we did the church thing for 3 years. And this is nothing against church. Matter of fact, we agnostics, if you're hearing that, that's not what I'm saying. We agnostics says we must embrace the church. But what I did is I did it instead of. I see people pray and meditate their way right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care if they're sitting in an ashram or they're kneeling in a church. In this organization, we can send our way right out. We're missing the whole point. See, we have 12 steps. We must have these 12 steps. And I love this line. It says, I'm going to put the other cute glasses on, just in case anybody didn't notice that. This other line in the book, and I love it. It's when Roland Hazard is, you know, with Carl Jung and all of that. It says, he's talking about his religious experience. And it says, this hope, however, was destroyed by the doctor telling him that while his religious convictions were good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital experience. So it tells me right there, be very, very careful that you don't put church in place of, that this 12 steps is what gets us connected to this power. We have to have it, guys, because the root of our problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. See, I wasn't selfish and self-centered. Charlie was. I mean, his was so obvious. But I was voted most likable in high school 4 years in a row. I am not selfish. And I didn't realize that what it's talking about is I'm not thinking too much of myself or too little of myself. All I think of is me. And if you hurt, threaten, or interfere with anything I have, I'll have to kill you. And I will. See, I'm more homicidal than suicidal. Now, I can get crazy enough to take both of us out, but that's doubtful most of the time. And this is all what I missed this for years. I did not, because I saw selfish and self-centered and said conceited and stingy. No, not me. Okay, I'm fine. And the book, what I love about that is, see, I can see selfishness and self-centeredness in others. Oh, my gosh. When God says that we've been given the power to help another drunk, that's not just with our drunk stories. That's not even with my experience. It's because I have the ability to see your selfishness that you can't see. I'm blinded to it in myself, especially if it's behind a kind motive. See, a kind motive, oh, my gosh. A kind motive is I was just trying to be helpful. As a matter of fact, if you're upset at me for my behavior, I'm going to explain to you why I did what I did so that you can, and that's called self-seeking. Remember, the people say we're controlling and manipulative. That makes me want to drink. I don't know why. I swear, I have got to have had some experience with the train in my drinking, but every time I hear it, I think, I'm telling you, I don't know what that's about. But I got enough work to do, and I am not writing inventory on that one to figure it out. But the thing is, and oh, I just went down a bunny trail. So I was talking about. Yep. Self-seeking. Thank you for whoever said that. Okay, so this controlling and manipulative, right? People say alcoholics are so controlling and manipulative. It's like, really? Duh. That's the root of my problem. It says that on page 61. If everyone would do as I wished, the show would be great. Manipulative? Yeah. Yeah, that's the root of my problem. I've got to get you all to act right so I'm okay. I'm driven to have that happen. And when it says that we're controlling and manipulative, we are self-seeking. See, this is a disease, a spiritual disease of self. We are outright mental defects, full flight from reality, cannot differentiate the true from the false. Our alcoholic life seems the only normal one, drunk or sober. So you take away the booze, the only thing that treated alcoholism didn't cause it, right? My booze treated this level of self-centeredness that I carry. And what I didn't understand is I thought the booze was the problem. Now, don't get me wrong. Booze is a big problem. But the book says in three different places, sobriety is not nearly enough. The drink is but a symptom. See, it's the only thing that calmed the beast of self-centeredness. And so you take that away, my problems heat up. You take away the 12 steps, and I'm not actively working the 12 steps. All I'm doing is meetings. You got a stark raving crazy person, and they're convinced that they're okay. They're just surrounded by a bunch of idiots. They can't help it. That's exactly what I did. See, people will say, have you seen Bob? No, I haven't seen Bob. Well, he's not going to meetings anymore. Don't misunderstand that. We make it sound like meetings are treatment for alcoholism. They do not treat alcoholism. Matter of fact, the fellowship is crucial for our triangle. It's the unity. Very important that we be in the middle of the herd. Woefully insufficient at keeping us sober, right? We'll keep us sober right up till we drink. That's why people kill themselves in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why people go out after 10, 15, 20 years. It's called untreated alcoholism. We need to call it what it is. I had it. I get to tell you about it. It's ugly. Oh, it gets uglier. Whoo, does it get uglier. And so I fall in love with AA. I do the church thing. All of a sudden, I'm 6 years sober now. I am absolutely crazy at the church. I don't like anybody in my church anymore. They're all bugging me because that's what happens to me. I step away from the 12 steps that make me see how self shows up for Katie. Where did she make decisions based on self that later placed her in a position to be hurt? Where did she set a ball rolling? Oh, I can tell you, you put me in church and I'm going to be pretty, pretty miserable if I don't have a 12-step program. And so what ends up happening, I'm sitting at an intersection. I remember this like it was yesterday. I'm sitting at an intersection. You could take a right on red. Wasn't that the best? Oh, that's better than the iPhone. You know what I mean? I mean, when they said you could take a right on red in Texas, that was big stuff. And so I'm sitting at this intersection, and this elderly woman is in front of me, and she is not taking a right on red. And I can't even believe it. And I sit in that intersection and try to convince myself how I can shove her into the middle of that intersection all in the name of Jesus. And I mean, I am crazy at this point. Stark raving sober. And so I'm just figuring out how to get, and I get home and I tell Joe, oh my gosh, Joe, I am not doing good. I actually was like sweating, thinking about shoving this woman into that middle of that intersection. She goes, you know, Katie, I'm not doing very good either. And I said, what should we do? And he goes, we need to get back to AA. And I said, absolutely. We went down to the noon meeting, the clubhouse that we used to go to, and we were sitting in there, and I leaned over to him, and I said, oh, my God, honey, we're home. We are with our people. We are home. And there was that relief. Now, what I didn't know, though, guys, is from that point on, I did what we call meeting-based sobriety. Meeting-based sobriety happens all the time in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not ill-intentioned. People think that meetings treat alcoholism. They don't. Nowhere in our book does it say that it does. The only thing that treats it is what? The 12 steps. That's all we know that treats it. Now, I didn't know that. I was 6 years sober. I'd done the steps. I was thinking they're linear. I wasn't looking at them as circular. I was looking at them as linear. And so all of a sudden, I love this line. I mean, I am absolutely crazy. I'm going to a meeting every day because I need a meeting every day. Are you with me on that? I need to get in that meeting to hear somebody say something that will give me the relief I need until the next meeting the next day. And what ended up happening is I was getting the relief but not the freedom. I was not connected to the power. I kept trying to go after this power thinking it was out here. I had no idea it's deep down inside of everybody. It says that in our book, that God is deep down inside everybody. And you know the other part was, how many of you guys when you were drinking heard God speak to you and say, don't do this. This is a bad idea. Don't get behind the wheel of that car. See, that was God talking to me. And all we're trying to do is get that voice a little bit louder. But it's blocked deep down inside here. I always thought it was out here. I was all jacked, man. I was all jacked. I was all over the place trying to learn this thing. And so I love this line in the book on page 25. It says, "For if you are as serious alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution." That's where the term middle-of-the-road comes from. Heck, I didn't know I hitched my wagon to middle of the road. Nobody's ill-intentioned here. I just hitched my wagon to the middle of the road. I mean, I did and didn't know it. It says, we were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation. And the other was to accept spiritual help. I assure you, there are people sitting in this room right now with intolerable situations. And when I suggest that they have spiritual help, they're not necessarily going to turn to the 12 steps. They're going to ask for a spiritual book to read or something, and that's all good. But we have to have these 12 steps. God gave alcoholics these 12 steps. You know why? Because we're missing filters. We are so selfish and self-centered. The book tells me the only way to get rid of it is with his aid. Well, how do I get rid of something I don't even know I have? I got to do the inventory process to find out what it is I have. And every year I'm sober, it changes. My ego is a shapeshifter. That's what it does. It dresses itself up differently every time. And the voices even change. Come on, Katie. You know what to do here. You just tell them this. You'll be fine. I'll take care of you. So that almost sounds like God talking sometimes, doesn't it? That ego just starts getting creative and more creative. You need to go ahead and detach from those people. They're not good for you. Set a boundary. Don't go back there. Well, the book doesn't tell me at all that for the alcoholic. Not at all. And so what ends up happening is I'm living a life with this God's will deal, right? I mean, I'm doing the baton like, here, God, you take over. It's getting heated down here. And God to take over is like, oh, he's moving way too slow. Give me that baton back. Give it back to me. I got it from here. I'd take it back. I'd start running the show. Oh, it's looking dark. Everybody's pissed off at me. Here, take it. You get it. I'm out of this deal, right? And that's what I did. I did a lot of slogan slinging. I think a lot of slogans are slung, in my experience, as if I don't know the book. Joe and I never touched the book. We were people who came out of the book. I knew the book was in the house, but I hadn't touched the book for 10 years, guys. Did not touch the book. Now, I went to a couple of big book study meetings where you read two paragraphs and then talk about your experience. I did no studying of the book. I did no reading of the book. I did no steps. That's what I did. I left myself in a very, very dangerous place. And, you know, and that's the other thing I like to say is when you become a slogan slinger like I was, and I was sponsoring people too. And, you know, you can sponsor people when you get to a certain age because you got a lot of life experience, right? So I can share experience with you on life. I mean, some of us are pretty good at giving life experience. But bringing you back to selfishness and self-centeredness being the root of your problem, no, that was not what I was doing. I was really more or less a life coach because it was just easier. I didn't know I wasn't doing the right thing. And so that's why sometimes when somebody is really doing poorly at a meeting, say somebody raises their hand and you can tell they are pissed. You know, I hate my boss's guts, you know, blah, 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 blah. After the meeting, I'll go up to them and go, it sounds like you got a pretty good resentment going. Yes, I do. I go, have you got about 20 minutes? Sure. You want to step out back? I said, let's write a four-column inventory. See, because that's what we need to do. That's my job. That's my job to ask you. If you're willing to do a quick four-column inventory, I can get you. I'm the vessel that can get you in touch with that power. Because you know what? That resentment will kill you. It says resentment is the number one offender. It kills more of us than anything else. From it stems all forms of spiritual disease. So all of a sudden, I get 5-6 resentments out there in the world. Before you know it, man, I don't even like my marriage. I don't like my job. I don't even like my children. See, and that's how it shows up. Now, I don't know that because I don't know that that resentment's the number one offender. I've drifted that far away. And so that's what I do with the guy. I just take him outside, man. I'll say, hey, listen, it sounds like you're really struggling here. I don't sling slogans at him. As a matter of fact, if you lobbed out acceptance is the key to this guy, he wants to punch you. Don't you hear the problems I have? See, acceptance is the key is a beautiful promise. But you're asking me to work the promises hoping the steps come true. It doesn't work that way for us. I've got to work the steps. And then I get the promise. Love and tolerance. Say you're standing there talking trash at the coffee machine. Am I the only one who's ever done that in AA? Okay, come on. I got to be with the group people. You got to start nodding your heads a little bit or else I think I'm the sickest one in the room. And I know I'm not, okay? We just got to wake you up, right? I like it. Father Leo and I were speaking last week and Charlie and Reno. And he says, I love that, Katie. She challenges you. And I said, sure, we're talking about a disease that kills people. How many of you guys know somebody that's died of the disease of alcoholism? Raise your hand. We're talking serious stuff here. You know, we are not a glum lot. We have a ball. But when it comes to talking about sobriety, what has happened? And so I'm telling you, the other thing is behind all of this slogan slinging and all of this stuff is remember what you're doing with it. You are not helping that person. You cannot give me the promise without the work. We alcoholics are missing a ton of filters. And so what ends up happening, my husband Joe, we're 10 years sober, right? Or 10 years back into AA. And we're going to a meeting a day. You know, I mean, that's the beauty of this whole story is we're going to a meeting a day. We were actively involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's crucial. It's very important. Don't ever hear me say there's anything wrong with going to meetings. It's just not treatment for alcoholism. And so what ended up happening is Joe got very sick, very, very sick. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. Man, he was sick. And the doctor that he was going to said, I think it's organic. And I don't know about you, but I mean, I smoke pot, organic pot. Don't you think the two go together? I mean, the guy says organic. I'm thinking, what, has he got like marijuana growing somewhere or what, you know? And he said, no, organic means that something is growing in him that's not supposed to be. Whoa. Well, that's pretty heavy. And I said, so what's the deal? And he said, I think he needs to go have some tests run. Well, we were both self-employed. We had catastrophic insurance. That's pretty scary. Remember, you hurt, threaten, or interfere with anything of mine. Oh, I'm going to get the job done, whatever it takes, right? We got a family. We are committed. We're in this deal forever. So I go to my meeting that I was going to, and personally I had to go to a really sick meeting. If you're not going to do anything in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you got to hang with people who aren't doing anything. Are you with me on that? You don't want to really hang with the people who have a lot of solution because they bother you. And they just going to keep coming at you with this level of work, and you're like, whatever. And so I'm with this really sick group, and a sick group, the way you can usually tell is they never really grow. There's about 12. Same 12. And so this girl says, Katie, you know what you ought to do? You ought to drive a school bus. If you drive a school bus, you get instant HMO. I went, really? And I thought, well, I've been in the fitness business. You know, it's a very flexible schedule. I can do this. I go down there. Now, let me show you the level of self-centeredness I'm dealing with. I go to get this job. And I love when Larry said his wife was sick. And he said, that's the level of self-centeredness he's carrying. It's the level of self-centeredness we're all carrying. See, you don't suffer from alcoholism and get to miss that. You're just asleep to it, period. That's just it. And so what ends up happening is I'm going to go down and get a bus job. I'm not going to think about the people that I'm getting the job from. I'm not thinking about putting them out. I'm not thinking about the parents that are going to meet me. I'm going to have this bus job for probably 6 weeks. We're going to get my husband that medical attention he needs, and I'm out of here. Are you with me on that? See, my level of self-centeredness is not even considering it. They're going to be disappointed. So be it. I mean, it's a school system, for gosh sakes, right? So I end up, I get this bus job. Oh, my gosh. First of all, let me tell you, I was the cutest bus driver in the whole fleet. Whew, they need a little bit of work, but that's a whole other story. So I am driving this school bus, and I get my husband, I call his doctor, and I said, okay, I've got the HMO, what do we do now? And he goes, you know what, just take him to the emergency room. And he must have told me they'd run Joe through some gamut of tests. And so I tell Joe, I said, okay, Joe, here's the deal. We're going to get you tested, and this guy's going to probably ask you to touch your nose, so you be sure and touch your elbow. Okay, he's going to tell you, touch your knee, you touch your nose, because we're failing this test. We're getting your brain scanned because I'm getting off the bus. Are you with me on this? Okay, so I am running the show. See, you hurt. Yeah, people say, oh, she needs Al-Anon. Well, that's the root of my problem, guys. I got to run the whole show. In order for me to be okay, I've got to run the show. That's what we alcoholics do. Would you Al-Anons agree with that? That the alcoholics run the show. That's what we do. Everybody needs to do as I wish, so the show will be great. Page 61. And so I get into that hospital, and the doctor comes in, and the doctor says, so you think something's growing in his brain? He's got all this kind of this going on. And I thought, yes, there is something growing in his brain. We don't know what it is, but he needs to have an MRI. And he goes, really? And like, where'd you get your MD? Yeah, I'll give you my MD, mister. You just give me, you know what I mean? I mean, at that point, I love the line in the book that says, when I get scared, I get cocky. It makes it worse. Anybody with me on that one? You scare me, I bow up, boy. I mean, that's how I show up. And now remember, if you show up the absolute opposite, we still suffer from alcoholism, self-manifested in various ways. How do you show up, right? So don't lose sight of the fact that just because this is my personality, it's how I show up when I get scared. And so Joe, the doctor, goes, well, Joe, why don't you touch your nose? And I swear my husband goes, I'm like, oh, my God. He just touched his nose. He's blowing the whole plan here. What are you doing? And the guy says, touch your elbow. He goes, and I thought, oh, great, plan B. I have no plan B. This is not good. And all of a sudden he says, doctor goes, Joe, how can you add 2 plus 2? And Joe was a cabinet maker, and he couldn't add 2 plus 2. And he says, you know what, we're going to go ahead and scan his brain. And I thought, well, thank you. I could have told you to do that earlier. And he takes him in there and he scans his brain. And Joe and I are sitting there waiting. And he comes in and he says, puts his arm right here. He goes, my God, he's got a gigantic mass in his brain. He says it's about the size of an orange. And my very first thought was, I'm going to be driving this damn bus for the rest of my life. That's the level of selfishness and self-centeredness that we live with. You hurt, threaten, or interfere with me, my first thought's usually pretty ugly. Now, I didn't say that to my husband. Of course I didn't. But that was my thought, was, my God, I'm going to be driving this bus forever. And I'll tell you what, I drove that bus for 3 years. See, I was only staying on it 6 weeks. I drove that bus for 3 years. My husband ended up having a meningioma. We thought it was lymphoma. He was going to live. It was the best situation that could have ever happened. But remember what I read. It says, for if an alcoholic fails to enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he cannot handle certain trials and low spots ahead. Joe and I were not equipped to handle this. He did not do well. And I'm driving this bus for 3 years. Oh, my God, you guys, I got bus stories that make you wet your pants out there right now. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Now, keep in mind, I'm stark raving sober. I'm in untreated alcoholism. I'm going to a meeting a day, and I am crazy. And I'm driving in a pretty affluent neighborhood, right? And I swear, any of you guys that know when the school bus comes around, you know the bus driver when the bus route is. So you know if you leave 5 minutes early, you can beat the bus, right? Or if you leave 10 minutes late, you can beat the bus. Well, there was a guy in a BMW that just bugged the crap out of me. I swear to God, I don't know what it was about him. But every time I'd see him coming, he just thought he could beat me. And he was far enough to where he could pass me. But I just wanted to mess with him because that's what we do, right? And I swear to God, I'd just throw my reds out. And he'd go, bring it. Go ahead, pass those reds. Who's got the power now, huh? And I swear, he'd look at me and go, what is wrong with you? It's like, just something about you bugs me. Just something about you bugs me. I swear one time I'll never forget this. This is part that I love where we say, you know, most alcoholics say they don't lie. Right. Yeah, we all lie on some level. We'd like to think we don't, but on some level we will all tell a white lie. That's how we make it easier, right? And there was a place that had two humps, and you could get that bus going really fast. I drove a gas-powered bus, and you could get it going really fast, and I could blow those kids from the back seat about 5 feet forward. I mean, you hit those two little spots, and you just flew them over the edge. And there was five little boys, and they would say to me, it was the last route, last of my ride. He'd go, come on, Miss Kate, come on, come on, come on, come on. I said, okay, you guys, if anybody ever sees me doing this, man, I am in trouble. And I said, get in the back. And so when you shoot them over those things, you have to come to a total stop, because you had to take a right turn, right? And so all of a sudden I go, okay, get ready. And you just, whoa! And I gas that thing and we go flying over those two things. And when we come down, I hit the brakes. And when I hit the brakes, the whole back end of the bus goes, choo! And I swear it was just silence. It was like, what the hell just happened? And all of a sudden, I mean, the kids go, okay, what was that? It's like, I don't know. We get out of the bus. I have blown all four valve stems off the back end of the bus. And I mean, those kids were like, pew! They were gone. That bus is like this. And I swear, I'm like this. I go, get on the radio, turtle bus to base, turtle bus to base. They go, yeah, this is base, turtle bus, what's up? I go, man, I got no idea. I just came to a stop, and all four of my valve stems blew off. And you could hear Billy go, say again. And I swear, Billy, we're not going anywhere. That back end of that bus is flat, right? Billy comes out, and he looks up that hill, and he looks at me, and he goes, nothing happened? I said, nothing happened. See, I can't lose that bus job. That's my insurance. I will lie if you hurt, threaten, or interfere with anything of mine, sober or drunk. And Billy just like that thought, okay, well, you know, she knows she's lying. I know she's lying, but whatever. So my husband is sick. Got pretty bad brain damage. Very difficult to live with. The doctor tells him he'll never work another day in his life. It's dark in our home. Dark, dark, dark. Now remember, he always had 6 years more sober than I. And at this point, he's 23 years sober. We're living in what I call the bedevilments, guys. Bedevilments are on page 52, something very important to be aware of, especially if you're in tremendous pain. It says we were having trouble with our personal relationships. This is what we were talking about. We couldn't control our emotional nature. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. Remember, the new terminology in 2012 is anxiety. It's the same thing. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. When I was on that bus, I was in such a dark place and so depressed. I'm not working the 12 steps. My world's falling apart. I go to my doctor. What is he going to do when I tell him those things? He's going to put me on an antidepressant. Of course he is. I had 3 blow-in-the-bag anxiety attacks because that's what untreated alcoholism will show up as. Now, I'm not saying we don't need medication in these rooms, but am I saying we're a little over-medicated? Yeah. I didn't need medication, but I had to have it at that point because I was in untreated alcoholism. I had no idea. My doctor's not going to go, Katie, you know what you need? You, Missy, need a spiritual awakening. He's just not going to say that to me. Well, here's the really sad thing, and this is what I think ends up happening. See, when I'm in untreated alcoholism, what I don't know is I got the malady all over me. And what happens when I have the malady all over me? All of a sudden, I break a tooth. Pretty simple. I go to the doctor, the dentist. He says, Katie, you're going to have a root canal. Great. $1,500 more bucks, whatever. I go to that endocrinologist or whatever he is. And he said, endonology, endro is correct. I'm right on the front end of that deal. And he says, you know what, Katie, you're going to need a little Vicodin. I go, you know what, I sure am. Thank God. This is going to hurt bad, isn't it? Yeah. So you see, when I have that malady on me, I take that Vicodin. And you know what it does? It triggers the allergy. And the next thing you know, man, I'm taking more Vicodin than I'm supposed to take. Next thing I'm doing is I'm scheduling more dental work. And that's what happens. We watched a buddy of ours do it. It was sad. It was all behind a broken tooth. And I tell you, I'm sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous telling people, I'm not going to drink. Oh, for God's sakes, I'm not going to drink. As if I've got the power of choice. That sounds like somebody who's choosing not to drink. I've lost the power of choice. And so I don't know I'm going to drink. I'm just going to take 4 Vicodin instead. Right? Anything that takes care of the malady. And we lose a ton of people to pills. And that's how that deal works. Well, let me just fast forward. I got about 10 more minutes, so some of y'all that are falling asleep need to start pinching yourself. Pinch. Stay awake. So what ends up happening is... The book says, and I love this, guys, because it's very, very true. It says, for if an alcoholic failed to enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he can't handle the certain trials and low spots ahead. My husband at 23 years went back out, and he ended up dying of a heroin overdose. So he wasn't even going to die from the brain tumor. But see, we couldn't handle that. He couldn't handle that. He went in there and started convincing the doctors to give him all kinds of meds. They're giving him Clonopin. They're giving him everything. Anything he asked for, he got. It was absolutely heartbreaking. And I'd have told you he went back out because of that brain tumor. Today I understand we were in untreated alcoholism, and he went back out because he did not have the needed power. That's what I'm talking about. And you almost lost me. At that point, at 18 months, I was ready to throw it all away, and Charlie drugged me around. By God, it's wonderful to have a best friend that's got spiritual consent that will drag your butt when they see you dying. And he said, Katie, we are going to go get you some help, man. He said, we're going to go to this big book study. I'm like, big book study? Whatever. I don't want to be at a big book study. I really kind of hate the big book, if you want to know the truth. Right? I did. I did not like the big book. And we end up going and we meet Mark Houston, and our life absolutely changed. Little did I know I was in the lifeboat. I did not know I was in the lifeboat. My world was falling apart. I was in the darkest of the darkest days of my life. Anybody who's been there knows exactly what I'm talking about. It was so dark. And I called this girl to be my sponsor, and she said, I'm telling her all about Joe, and, you know, she knew Joe, and it's been 18 months, and it's dark. Boy, it's painful. It's sad. And she says, Katie, you know where your big book is? I said, I think I can find it. And she says, do me a favor. I want you to turn to page, I want you to read 60 to 63. And I thought, surely that must be the part of the book that says some of us have it harder than others. It's got to be in there somewhere. And I happened to flip over to page 62 first, where it says selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think the root of our problem. And this is exactly what I did. I said, that bitch. I'm not a fan of cussing from the podium, but that story's not effective if I say witch. And I picked that phone up and I said, Marty, did you not just hear me? I mean, I'm telling you what's going on with me, man, the pain I'm in, and you want to tell me selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble? Can y'all see me doing that? Oh, yeah, like it was yesterday. And she said, Katie, there's a fine line between sorrow and self-pity. And I'm afraid you've drifted into self-pity behind this. Wow. Who has the power to tell me that, man? I love this. A moment of clarity is of no value if not followed by action. I had a moment of clarity that she was absolutely right. I am 15 years sober and I am dying. I've lost my husband and my world is over. And little do I know that the answers to all my problems are in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was there the whole time. Who would have known? How do you know what you don't know? And so what ends up happening, man, I have this second surrender. It's a surrender to the third step. It's a surrender to understanding what that third step really means. If you haven't read 60 to 63, I strongly encourage it. My sponsor is all about, Katie, it's in my DNA. It doesn't go away. What happens is I have a toolkit that's full of tools that I get to use. And so she tells me, she says, it's not that you think too much of yourself or too little of yourself. You just think of you all the time. You go from self-righteous to self-pity. Doesn't matter. You're still in self. So I have to have a sponsor that's going to tell me that I'm a self-seeker even when trying to be kind. That my problems are of my own making. Where did I set the ball rolling? Where did I place myself in a position to be hurt? She says, if you want to be free, the problem has got to be you. Period. So we get down. I have to have a second set of eyes looking at me at all times. And I love it says in the terms that God makes these fabulous terms, right? It says God doesn't make too hard of terms for those who seek him. What are the terms? Stay close to me. Perform my work well. Well, I got to get close to him to stay close to him. How do I get close to him? I got to unblock what I got going on. And trust me, the book says, having just made conscious contact with God, we're going to pay for this presumption and all sorts of absurd thoughts and actions. Having just made conscious, every day I make conscious contact. I don't get it and keep it. I got to get it every day. Just like a diabetic checks their blood sugar levels. I got to do it every day. And if my prayer and meditation is 3 minutes, that's about the kind of program I'm going to be walking around with. If I'm not doing an active 10th step where I'm doing a spot check inventory, watching for resentment, dishonesty, selfishness, and fear, and then as the evening comes about, I do an evening review, which is the 11th step, to check my work, then I take that into my prayer and meditation. What are my corrective measures? See, we alcoholics got to keep our finger on the pulse of this self-centeredness we must or it kills us. It kills us. That's how self-centered we are. Extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. I thought I didn't even have it. Now today I know I got it so bad that I've got to do this work. I don't ever, ever, ever want to live in those bedevilments again. They are too painful. As a matter of fact, the bedevilments drive me into this work. Because by the time, if I'm going back in those bedevilments, by the time I take that drink, it is the solution. See, alcohol was the solution. It wasn't the problem. And that's the part that was killing me. You know, and then I love this part where it's the 12th step. 12th step is to carry the message. We don't get an option to not. We don't sit around meetings waiting for somebody to ask us to sponsor them. We do that. We go up to them. Hey, are you new? Yeah. How much time do you have? 3 days. Have you got a sponsor? No, I don't have one yet. Hey, I'd be happy to take you through the work. I know how to do the work. I know how to take you through the work. Would you give me the privilege of doing that? They don't even know where the bathroom is. They're going to say yes. Sure. Okay, fine, whatever. We don't want the newcomer to try to figure out who to pick. That is too big a decision for them. Trust me. They'd be stupid, man, stupid. So, oh, and you got to find some humor in that. Come on, we've all been new or we've sponsored. They got to find that. So, and I love it says, nothing so much ensures immunity over drinking as 12-step work. So if you're not sponsoring, get in the work, get a message of depth and weight, and get out there and carry the message. I'm a big fan of the tapers, huge fan of the tapers. Let's give them a big hand. Oh, my gosh. I don't want anything to get the tapers to go away. I'm telling you, I want the tapers here. This is our history. Every day is our history. And over there, what Charlie and I did is we got big book studies. And we listened to them over and over and over and over again. And we'd look at the book and we'd talk in depth. What do you think that means? What is this? Then we'd have the experience behind it, guys. What I didn't realize is that the tapes are fabulous. You just have to keep putting them in your head. The book says alcoholics are undisciplined. We let God God discipline us. How does he do it? Through CDs, through other members of AA. That's how this deal works. It is absolutely the most exciting thing. I can tell you two things, guys. There's a lot of hope for the new guy out there. I know you see me getting the book. You see me wrapping it up. Some of y'all are like, God almighty, I see that fire hose in this girl. But I still have another minute and a half, so. But what we think there's a lot of message for the new guy. I'm afraid of middle management. We are losing middle management in Alcoholics Anonymous. Go to birthday night. There's a gigantic gap between 10 and 15 years. Where are those people? This is a problem we have in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was one of them. And so one of the things that I strongly encourage you to do is to step up and get some of those CDs. Start listening to the work. Start carrying the message. Put those people out there in the world. It's absolutely amazing. Just stay in the boat. The boat is the lifeboat. No fighting in the lifeboat, by the way. We don't fight amongst ourselves. No fighting in the lifeboat. We're in the lifeboat. Stay the course. Don't get out of the boat no matter what. Thank you very much.